Kirsty Neat interviewing Captain Kinley on the 15th of February 1996. We're on side two of the tape now, and I just ended the last side by asking you what Douglas was like to negotiate Douglas Harbour, so maybe we could start from there.
Very good. Well, it's quite a good harbour, actually. It can be tricky sometimes entering with strong swing tides, which are high up, and quite a current was across the harbour bows. But the depth of water is quite deep enough as far as for our ships, right up to, unless there's a spring tide, dead low water, of course, it's quite shallow. But in my time, when I first joined the company, we had no breakwater. It took the British Rail to come along before we got a breakwater. And all those years without a breakwater, you see that brass plate in my door there, that goes back to an old bylaw, which has never been rescinded to my knowledge. When you became a master, you had to have a brass plate on your door, because there wasn't a telephone communication those days like there is today, you see, long before even the 1930s. So the policeman came along, got orders to tell the master to come back to the ship, and the crew to come back to Douglas. How the crew had either, I don't know. And because the wind was inshore, you see, a harbour master bring you on. But I'm ready to be already down anyway, because they know themselves those southeast winds, and they'd be down there in any case. But that was the bylaw of the company. So the policeman come along with his old lamp, you know, probably a candle power, and shine on the door, and he'd see Kinley or whoever it was. Well, the skipper lives in here, you see. That was the idea those days, so it's going back a long time. But that's why that little plate is there. I've kept it there as a memento, you see.
So you had to go, they'd come out to make sure that you...
Oh, you had to come down when the wind came inshore in Douglas.
Yeah.
If there's any strength in anything up to a five or beyond that, or even before that, you all had to come back to the ship. Because you get quite nasty. The engineers would raise steam and have to get out.
Right, so you'd have to take it.
I'd take the vessel out, and you're on a lee shore. That means you're down on a windy shore, the wind is blowing in. And it could be quite a nasty job. Somebody just had to go around the peel, but very often you'd heave tow out in the bay. Or even to hang on until sailing time.
Right.
It was quite tough going.
You had to keep an eye to make sure that...
Oh, your ropes breaking, you know, and the gang was going like this. That's a thing, you see.
Goodness me.
Yes, yes.
So they'd turf you off into the middle of the harbour sometimes, so you'd have to wait there.
Right. it was quite tough. And tough for the passengers too, because when you're backed out into the sea...
You're rocking.
You're seasick before we'd left some of them.
Did you ever get seasick?
No, never.
Never?
No. All my school days was spent with my father coasting. Most of my school days anyhow, you see. Trained to Dublin.
Right.
Most of the time, and up around the west of Ireland and all that place. I used to love it.
So you're quite used to being in rough
seas. Very hardened to it.
Yeah.
You see?
So what's your cure for seasickness then, if you're someone's...
Well, people say, go and have a good meal. And then once it's up and finished with the end, you're fine, I believe. I wouldn't recommend it just the same.
Doesn't sound too good to me.
No, indeed. Well, I've seen some funny things at sea where people have been seasick. It's quite nasty.
It is, yeah.
Yes. Something be laid out there, you had to go down and render first aid to them. That's another thing, the chief officer's job.
Oh, right.
Render first aid. See, all masters and mates too, before they can sit for the ticket, they've got to have a first aid ticket. I was looking at mine there today, as a matter of fact. For mate, you've got a second class ticket. For master, you've got a first class. But those days, you know, rather strange, you had what they call can oil for upper burns. And you had the ordinary bandages. And for arteries, you had these, what's it they call them now? You put a pad there, and a pad on the wrist, you see. Yes, yeah, yeah. Chucked up like a bird ready for the oven. But that was us those days, and splits and all that sort.
You see,
all that's all finished now. You see,
yeah.
Well, they used some certain amount of splits yet, I understand, but not. And iodine was another thing. It was rough going the first day of those days.
Did you ever have to administer anything?
Oh yes, quite often.
Yeah.
Oh yes, quite often. You're a bad person. Always something falling. I remember one day, you know, many years ago in the Gaiety Theatre, they had shows there all the summer. And this particular woman, she's going back, she's a real blown real hard. And she wasn't allowed to take her dogs. She had about six dogs, little dogs. You do an act, you see. She weren't allowed to bring them into the cabins in those days. So she had them out underneath the seats all the way along the ship's side, you see, against the rail. And she had them in underneath there. But this other woman there, some passenger there, she both gave a bit of a roll. And she stepped back and stepped on the a dog's paws were sticking out. And the dog bit her. You see? Right across the inch, right across there. Oh, it was a nasty cut. The thin skin that's on the top of that part of your foot, you see, up here, is very thin. And it had been cut like a V and rolled back. But my job was to get back, you see, flattened out, and put a stitch or something in it.
Really?
And the only place I could take her was in the ladies' cabin, you see. And the feet up in a wash basin. We'd no first aid room.
No room to actually do that.
Oh, yes. The two students, both of six misses, was there. They were students those days. And another called Elsie Carlisle, I said. You hold her while I flatten this down and put on they called some stitch. It's kind of it's in a reel and it's flat, it's transparent, it's very good. And flatten it right out, just stitch, one little stitch to hold it, and then put this over it. And then the lint and what on the top, you see.
Yeah.
We're going to Fleetwood, there's a hospital there, it's quite close. I think it's called the North Lawn, so I wasn't too sure about that. You went up to the hospital, any of the doctor there, yes, well, that's all you carry on home, that's good enough time being. That's probably pretty
much.
Well, you get all sorts of little accidents.
I suppose where people are involved, anything can happen.
Oh, yes, well, they fall downstairs and things like that, you see. And the children will run, they will run round the ship, see. You see them running up the ladders and sliding down and things like that, so you're bound to have accidents, see.
So there were cabins, dining rooms, and then were there lounges for people
to just sit in? Lounges, yes, beautiful lounges.
Yeah.
Even in the old ships, the very old ships. And used to have bunks, you know, in all throughout the ship, in the old boats, in the old ships, in the Bilson Fleetwood. And what you'd do, there'd be a row of seats right round this dairy saloon. And cushions going right round the seats. And rather than they'd take and put boards at the side, the slots, and turn them into bunks.
Oh.
Mm. Yes.
So anywhere.
That's all gone now, that's all finished.
Yeah.
Yes, oh yes, but it's quite an experience. I'm myself passing it, another man passing it boat. And you meet some wonderful people too.
I know.
Oh yes.
What uniform did you wear when you were working on the vessel?
This is my last trip to Ben. I brought her into Liverpool and we had a dinner aboard that day and I sailed the next day to Douglas home.
Right. So you'd have worn something like this when you were working?
Yes, that's the same one, yeah.
Yeah.
So very often the second mate would have a boiler suit if he was doing any work in the harbour, cleaning the ship up. You see.
Right.
But the part you hit that on most of the time.
Right.
Okay. That's a like Liverpool landing stage. You see, we had a nice dinner aboard after that. So my pilot colleagues aboard. I sailed for quite a while with the late Captain Tom Woods. Well, he's dead now. And he was a fine master, Captain Tom Woods. Wonderful chap. I was with him the first winter of the war. It was a nasty winter, second mate with him. And you had to be spot on doing the navigation. You never trouble you. And one night, I'll tell you, this is a true story. This is rather interesting, this. It was after the war had finished when I came and left. I was in the pilot service up to then. That's another story. we go across. It was our own minds became loose, you see. The war had finished now. And they're huge mines. And we're going to Ostend a lot. You went up off the Thames and you picked a boy up there. I just forget the name of it now. And you went right across then for Ostend, allowing for tides and so forth. I think it was every 7 miles you picked a boy up, see, unlighted boy. and mines, a lot of mines adrift. Well, this particular night, I was second mate of the day back then, and I was on watch going across. You know, Tom, Tom Woods, he was down in his cabin, you know, lying his pipes in, he had a wonderful old chap. And at the wheel was a fellow called Harry Halsall, Ports and Mary Sea. And none of them called Johnny Clues out on his port wing. And Little signaled them up the ferry bridge. And he was up there, and I had a fate, I think I had a peel man, my starboard watch. It was a big, I just forget his name, I was thinking it. And it was a blowing about 4, 6, 7, squalling to 7 and went down to 6 and 5. And there's a lot of clouds in the sky, and every now and then there'd be a break in the moon, beautiful moon, but just breaking occasionally. You talk about the good Lord watching over us.
Uh-huh.
And we all spotted it the one time, here, right in the light from the sky down with the moon break. Here, as you can see, the mine. The huge thing was big as this room. You see, I said to Harry Halsall, "Hey, for God's sake, hard to stop it. We're going full speed. When you go full speed and ship, she lies over the gut, you see. Hard to starve it, right?" And this was a little signal, and he jumped on the flying bridge. Oh, he didn't break his legs onto the bridge. The Clewis was out in the port wing. He came dashing through and tripped over the step that the quarterman was standing on. And he flipped at my feet. And then we went out, and then midships and hard to port. And of course, the ship rolled like that and went down along our side like that.
Missed it.
But why I tell you this is it was from Captain Tom Woods. He said, "You're a wonderful chap, because the ship rolled like this, you see." So he came up, he looked at me. "What's wrong, huh?" What's wrong, huh? "Well, sir, I don't think you'll get so near as a mine, end onto a mine, and miss it in your life before ever will again." "Aye, that's right. Good, look up, yes, yes. All right, huh, you know what I want me to tell you." He was a wonderful chap. He'd been confidence in you see.
Yeah.
And one of the finest chaps I ever sailed with. There's another like him, the late Captain Bill Watson. He also was a fine scout. Yeah, that's right. Yeah. It's good.
Were you superstitious at all before you?
What?
Were you superstitious when you were sailing the boat?
Oh, yes, we were superstitious people. There was a lot of us gone with the boots and out, you know. But we were nice. Seamen are.
Yeah, yeah.
They are superstitious.
What sort of superstitions did you have? What sort of things?
Well, it's a very different things. Go in, come out. If you go in the house, you come out the same door as you went in. That's one thing. Because that's all you are. There's nothing to them, really, I don't suppose.
Yeah.
And one of your best friends at sea, especially coasting, is a seagull. You come out on the gas and you just keep even with the bridge with you like that. You see him looking at you there. And off you go. You know then, the way ahead is all right.
Really?
Yes. The way you take the way ahead. Or we're approaching land. Now go up to St. B's Head. I was in a run from Liverpool to St. B's on the Whiting ships. And St. B's Head is kind of cutting light. That's a light that's in more than is out. You see? It's out, in. Goes out for a few seconds, in and out.
Right.
It's a cutting light. There are very few of them about now. And St. B's Head is very high and you can steer a course and get up quite close to it. But if you get too close, you shut the light out. So if that old gull came along, you knew you were clear. You were going clear. He'd keep with you like that. You knew you were clear. Yes. Little things like that will bring memory back.
Yeah.
Sailor's best friend is a seagull at night time.
That's good.
Oh, aye, but the Liverpool Bar is a very treacherous place. At night time going in there. And Fleetwood can be a nasty place too. There's such a strong tide going on. See? But with one character, a master called Wilfred Fontrell, he was in the First World War, and he knew exactly what was happening down there, down Southampton, at the naval control. He had no time for naval control at all, but he knew what was going on as a second officer. And a second officer, he's a navigating officer. And it's his job, when they get the route, this is down, I'm down Southampton now, the war is on. When you get the route, you might be going to Calais or Rouen, or might be going to the different ports. You had you're routed, you see, by the Admiralty. And you had to keep to those routes, the different courses, you see. And the second mate's job was to make these courses out, you see. So anyhow, you wouldn't remember. There was a phony war after the first winter of the war. There was a phony war. Everything was quiet, and we were shipped up to the Bristol Channel. I was shipped to Ben McCree, the Lady of Man, the Fenella I was in then, and King Arthur, all shipped up to Bristol Channel port. And we were in that port, the entrance to the Bristol Channel, to Bristol, I forget the name of the port, it doesn't matter anyhow. We were right on the top of the Bristol Channel. All of a sudden, things started to be... When Rommel was being chased by Eisenhower, then it broke up again. It started again, the war, good and proper. I think I'm right there. And, of course, we had to get back into Southampton as quick as we could. And we all got our marching orders, went to sail, and the route we had to take. Now, you won't believe what I'm going to tell you. This concerns the Wrens during the war. Mm-hmm. And I had a private cabin up in the shelter deck doing the navigation. The charts all out there. So it was my job to do to get the route out. And Alec Lucas, the second officer, and Wilfie Quatro was the master, and I was the second mate. And I was making these out, you know. They go down courses, right down the Bristol Channel, until we came down to Land's End. And we had to go down, round the corner, Land's End, and into the English Channel. And one boy there called the Rundle Boy, see? We had to be there at a certain time the next morning, about 11 o'clock in the morning. Had to be there, not a minute before or a minute behind. We had to be there. It took some working out. But as we were going down along the course in the Bristol Channel, according to the directions I had, we had to go to right side, across the land, over land, you see. So I took my own courses then, down and round about, and to be there on the right time, because you knew the speed of your ship. So anyhow, eventually, the second mate came aboard and the Captain Quattro. He's a high-pitched voice. Alec Clickers, he said, Captain, you better have a look. Harry's in there doing the route. Oh, how's Har getting on? He says, I've got to tell you this to get the story properly. How's Har going on, Alec? Well, he's got a puzzle here, sir. Oh, I'm a puzzle. What puzzle is that, Har? So he came in. Well, sir, have you got rollers on this ship? What do you mean? He says, well, you'll have to have wheels or something. Why, what's the matter? It's all short of you, see. Oh, by damn, right into my apple cart. I've been bugging and pressing around with these damn rambling in the First World War, and I'm all about it. I've got to tell you this to get the gist of this, you see. Anyhow, all right, Mick, I've got the courses down, sir, and round to the English Channel, off Southampton. My dad, yes, how fancy that, huh? We have got wheels on them, then, that's all it is. Anyway, to cut a long story short, we got round and we sailed that night. Beautiful night. It was always fine weather those days, but it came in fog. Now Alec took us, instead of one being watch, Alec, we took the watch ourselves, the whole right up, round up to the two of us up the bridge together. And I couldn't get over this, why we had to beat the Rundle Storm at 11 o'clock, which we were. And Alex says, I don't know, damn, I don't know what Alex says. But anyway, Skipper doesn't seem to care a damn any. Well, Alec went down, as a matter of fact, he just lots of brandy opened up. We just plenty of board that we were bonded stores twice a week. So it was cold, bitterly cold.
Absolutely.
You see, on an open bridge, where the quartermaster was a deer in the wheelhouse, but we had to be out on the open bridge, you see. And I says to the bosun, flash the lights on for a second. I sense something. He says, there's something wrong. I sense there's something wrong here. And I said, and he flashed the lights on again. All ship all lit up, all navigation lights. And immediately, there's lights right ahead of us both sides. There was another convoy coming down from Southampton. And we went up the stairs of them like that. That's why we had to be at that point at a certain time. We went up the stairs of them. We were coming down. Here they're coming down like that. And us going up the centre. By the office, he took a chance.
A close thing, wasn't it?
Because what if we did? We're all doing about 18 knots. You see? It was only a flash. Or speak to each other and passing a distant work. Distant word in the darkness and silence.
It's really depending on your skills, isn't it?
You had to be pretty keen. Anyhow, and they had to be true.
Yeah, exactly, yeah.
So anyhow, Anna came up. She felt like a little bit of a roll. What's wrong, Alec? I said, well, I'll tell you what's wrong, Alec. And I told him, oh, damn it. I'll go down to the bottle's office. Anyhow, when we got to Southampton, they cut the show a long story. The second mate had to go ashore with the captain to get the route for the next night, and we were Commodore the next night. We put Commodore. Get to me bloody apple cart. So up we went. And we went to a hotel outside in the Southampton Road, outside Southampton Dock Gates, called the what a big hotel there, huge, it's a beautiful hotel, I forget it, but it was just outside the dock gate. And a big wide staircase, all half as wide as this, you see. We had to go up to about two lots of stairs, you see. And every time there's a soldier with a bayonet coming to attention, because they're a uniform, you see, what you had to be. Now look here, young fella, watch this, that damn place is sharp, you know. What is a character? Any, I'll put him out.
Alright, I'll
turn
it off
for them. Come on. Well, they said to get all route instructions from up, and he was covered all this night. When we got to the top stair where the naval control was, a rain came along. Who are you? I'm Master and Commodore tonight of convoy number so and so. Oh yes, well you'll have to wait here. What do you mean, he says, Missy, wait where? There, because they're in conference and going up and down. Come on, Harry, says to me, open the door, march. He knew them, you see. Damn bitches, he says. Anyway, Marsh, and they all looked up, these big, this one massive gold plate on me, you know. Who are you? Who am I? I'm the master of the so-and-so ship, you see. And I'm the commodore for tonight. And I want my route instructions taken off, and you want them now, he said. So he said, now there's something else to tell you. And I had to tell the tale about the chart. Don't believe it, don't tell you. You're damn well, I can't believe it. You hear that, Commander so-and-so? And we see to ourselves, oh, the old Nelson, just you. Oh, yes, Captain, we'll sweet see, so that has been a mistake. And I wonder, these damn girls, you know, there's no use in these, what's it they call them, those fear to call them. He said, we'll have to think about it. He said, it'd be a mistake with one of the wrens, you see. He cut across the... I don't know how she's able to do it, how we're going to get down there, but she cut across the country. But that did happen.
Amazing.
But Wilfie went to town on that side, because he had such a punishment from them when he was second officer in the first film.
Right,
you see.
Right.
So he's
going to let them get away with it.
Oh, so I said, that night we're leaving Southampton, we're going to put you on top line tonight, Captain. I said, we'll give them commanders up there, Commodore, such a slouching with your tongue. It's really pretty accurate to me. That's right, but we will be. Oh, there's some characters those days.
Absolutely, sounds brilliant. Oh, so yes. The ships were called up by the Admiralty, was it 1939, 1940 or?
That was when the war broke out, 1939, wasn't it?
Yeah.
We were taken over immediately.
Right, straight away.
As soon as the war started. Well, a few couple of days was questioned just before, a couple of days. Now, I came through the first winter of the war for the band. We were doing a big flu epidemic, you know, too. And anyway, the Captain Woods and myself left on deck of the officers.
Right.
But anyhow, and we're snowing this night too, snowing, you know, we had three gangways out loading troops. And the OC troops came to me, he says, oh, Mr. Mate, he says, we can't up the gangways anymore, they're snowed up. So I went to the commander at the Captain Woods. I said, Captain, we'll have to stop loading passenger troops, sir. Why, what's wrong? The gangways are snowed up. We just can't get up the gangways, and that's all there's to it. We have to stop. They're on the men are trying to get up with their kids, one thing or another. All right, tell the OC troop, don't they, what the hell he wants, he said. You see, of the OC troops. Anyway, we didn't sail that. I think we sailed that evening, the following evening, when we snowed down.
So when the Admiralty called up the ships, were they taken over to Liverpool to be refitted,
Well, when the Admiralty took a ship over,
yeah.
I don't even what type of ship it was. Now, for instance, the Mona's Isle that I was in when the war broke out, they brought her in and put guns on her, you see, and all sorts of armament, or bombing, shell, firing, all that, and guns. Machine guns, air guns, all that sort of type of things, you see. But we didn't in our passenger boats, we nothing.
You didn't
we wouldn't dare put a gun on. we become a man of war then, right. And they get bobbish, you see. Bobbish in any case, you see. But we were a warship. As long as you had no armament, of course, it's just an ordinary ship. It still bombed you, of course. Yes.
So they didn't fit you out. So, I mean, what about, was it still as plush inside when you were carrying troops? I mean,
what?
Was it still as posh inside the ships?
Oh, yes.
To start off with,
pretty rough towards the end. And the commodores, when they tried to find you, they were up on the boat deck. That's where they went. They loved up there, deck chairs and whatnot. But only the commodores went well out, or majors, from majors up.
So how long were you at Southampton for, relieving?
Oh, well, she was down, the boats were down there from the day the war broke out, right through the whole first winter of the war, and then I tend to went to the Bristol Channel for a short time. Yeah. And after that, then, till after the evacuation, see? Now, I'd been down there the whole winter. I hadn't been home. A father called John Carush and I, nice chap with John, we were both sent down to leave the chief officer and second officer. And we hadn't been home. So I was sent home then for 3 weeks on the home run, plate with Douglas, you see. But I was only there about just over a week. And we had to go into Birkin, into dry dock to be degaussed. You see, they brought out then the magnetic mine. And you had to be degaussed, you see. The ship had to be magnetized that the attraction from steel would go away,
right.
West instead of east, you see. That's a wonderful idea. And we went into Birkenhead to have this done in the dry dock, and here's a telegram waiting for me to proceed to Dunkirk to Southampton forthwith. And I didn't be home for a few days. I got down to join the Fenella, see. Well, she was lost at Dunkirk. She was there before I got down there. But I joined the Viking in the dry dock. She was in charge of a collision with a small Norwegian ship. A Norwegian ship I'd had on the pilots, one of the pilots, and the pilot doesn't remember, but anyhow, that's another story. But anyhow, we joined and then we went out. But by the time we were ready to take passengers, Dunkirk had finished. There's no one there. But we were sent there to the vicinity of Dunkirk. No one knows why, because we were a coal burner with about 4 double-ended boilers. And you imagine at night time we're filling these with coal, the flames come out of the funnel and smoke. Any of the escorters with us, he said, he quoted part of the Bible. You're a ball of smoke by day, and a ball of flame by night. We can see you 20 miles off, and they could. They couldn't have sent a worse ship there. And there's nobody in Dunkirk, and he'd gone. So we got word, as the night that Italy declared war on us. So anyhow, we got in this vicinity, you know, of Dunkirk, in the area, of the harbour area, and we got word to go to St. Valery. Now, to start with, we couldn't get into St. Valery. And another thing, the Germans already had passed through it on the road to Le Havre, you see. Then we got word, proceed immediately to Le Havre. I was on the watch, and I got this word on the telegram that Italy had declared war as from midnight. See, and I said to the third mate, now take this down and show it to the captain, and put it down on the mic on my room. What he did do, but it was missing when I went down there. I wonder after the war, I wonder what happened to that, you know. Anyway, we got into Le Havre. Was hell let loose in there. And we anchored a bit too close to a French man of war. We'd go to anchor to where we required to go in the harbour. And we anchored a bit too close to a German French battleship. We found that out too, because Jerry came over and he's in that sea watch room. And he started pelting us with from the air. I can see one plane come over here like that. And he put a bomb each side of us, straddled us, put a wolf like and she'd go like this, and then he hit the man of war. And astern of us, there was a Polish ship called the Chorobi, and she was converted to a hospital ship. Well, she got a direct in, she was right, capsized right over. Fortunately, there's no medical students at home, but no nurses aboard. And Pétain, you may have heard of Pétain, they used to governor in charge of France that time, didn't he? He tried to turn us against the Germans, you see. He was for the Germans, Pétain. Pétain or Pétain. It's spelled P-E-T-A-I-N, but it's pronounced Pétain. Anyhow, we had ordered then into Le Havre to get troops on board immediately. We were down there then alongside, we could get these troops aboard. And they're all Scottish, you see, all Scottish people. God, you had, and them men had been chased from Dunkirk, mind you. And we got them aboard, and we took the vice-consul of Dieppe and his wife on board too. And we were ordering these trips and overcome Jerry, give her another boom to sling. When they came over, an officer there blew a whistle, a soldier, you see, and all the soldiers dropped like that. But we were still gone.
You were still looking.
What was going on, you see? But most interesting. Anyway, we got orders then to stop the passing. Those that had gone ashore had to stay ashore, get the doors aboard again. We started to land them, you see, to fight back. It was too late. We had to get them aboard again and get out. So anyhow, the tugboat, we got the tugboat was towing us off. He was one to famoosh, famoosh. You got the wind up with the planes that are coming over good and proper. And he went out, we went ahead of his ropes, broke the rope, got into some propeller, and he stuck out there. Well, you shut up with them Scotchmen. You couldn't hear right it. And off we went. And the vice consul of Dieppe, he missed the boat, was leaving behind. But his wife was on board, she was a real lady, she was. And that morning, in Upper Southampton Water, going in for the boom defence. It was a lovely summer morning. We went in slow there. We had to stop the examination steamer, you see. God knows what for. Anyhow, the Scotchmen were all there, you know. She's a long forecastle head on her. Must have about 500 men in that forecastle head. With all their kits, their war kits, fighting. Rifles, gas masks, and all that type of thing. And they were laden, you know. Anyhow, the bell went behind the after funnel. She had two funnels for breakfast, you see. So, one Jack, hey Jack, give me your luggage and away and get the body beef, you see. Well, he came back, well, in the meantime, this fella, he got onto the rail, he wanted to relieve himself, you see. And this one was leaning on the rail, he got on the bridge, talking to me, you see, so she's a real lady. And she listened to them all, that language was, and the folks were there deadbeat. And she says, come on, Jack, take your body beef. I'm going to take him now, I've got something in my hand. What's in his hand?
I can imagine.
Yes, it's your imagination. Well, they're wonderful chaps. Anyhow, what long story we got off. Oh, and the examination board, where are you from? You see, Le Havre. He said, Le Havre. And I went like that, you weren't supposed to name the place. He said, they were Navy. You see, examination board. And he says, well, I said, port 23 or 24, just report. And he said, who you got on board? You see? I said, can't you damn well see who we got? About 3,000 troops. It was all in the kit. Well, more than any 4,000 troops, you see. We'd left 1,000 behind in the key. Aye, well, he said, you got any evacuees? And oh, we all evacuees. I said, Bert Dash, and that's what he said. And we all sort of evacuees. There's always a humorous side to a thing, you know. As desperate as may be, there's always a humorous side if you can find it. And this lady, she's like that. And the tears on down her cheeks. Yes. It was, and you know that, after the war, the vice consul, Auntie Epp, and his wife, they came to live in Castletown. Yes, she died recently, but he died, but she's still there, down the promenade in Castletown. Yeah. Yes.
But
that's one of the funny incidents you'll get.
Yeah.
Then we went from there then, post-haste, to evacuate St. Petersburg, the Channel Islands. Do you want me to carry on?
Yeah, do, yeah.
So, we eventually got there. It was a lovely summer morning when we got up around the island. See, I was because I was a navigating officer and we were all dead. Everybody was dead beat, you see. We've been on our feet for days. You got round, locked us, brought round, we anchored just on the North Bay. And the pilot came out, your boy, we were lobster fishermen, you see. And we're talking, we're going in at 9 o'clock, this is about 7:30, quarter to 8. So he said, I said, isn't there a channel goes out north of the island? Yeah. He said, that's, we were rooted, you see, away west of the island, but about 20 miles longer than we should have been, really. But must be reasonable, I suppose. Oh, he said, that's right. He says, what a bit. He said, is that? And he told me, and I got a back of a notice, a book like that, was notice to mariners. It was issued about twice a week with all the things that happened in the charts, what you were sailing in, like buoys being changed, depths of water and mines laid, you see, and you had to have them and then correct them in your charts. It's very important. Well, I'm back on one of these on the bridge, and I drew this sketch of this route we should take to get round the north side, with pencil on the back of this. Anyway, then into St. Peter's Port, alongside the jetty, it's a beautiful place. And here's a sight you'll never forget. There's a barracks come across up to the top of the quay, like I write the whole width of the quay. Beyond that, then there's about 1,800 children, 1,700 odd children. Some haven't thought it was wonderful. They had a gas mask and a little cup of buck and some sandwiches. Half of them were eaten by that. Then beyond that, then, about 50 yards or more beyond them, there's a barbed wire and the parents were there, you see. Well, some kids were crying their hearts out. And I thought they were in a wonderful time, running around, you see. Well, that's all those children, nearly 1,800, and the odd nun and the odd people. But while we're loading these children, something rather funny, humorous again, a woman came staggering aboard, you see. Hello, officer, she said. Do you want the key? It's the key of my pub, she said. It was called Mrs. Savage, anyway. It was called the Bull's Head or something like that, you see. And you can have it. But I'm not going to give it to that bloody Hitler, she said. Here, oh, there's the captain, see, there's the captain rises and the lady would like to speak to you. What is it, segment? He wants us to give you a pub. I beg your pardon, sir. Yes, I'm Mrs. Savage, I own the bloody pub and you can have them, so and so, sir. Yes. Here, captain, take the piss. He couldn't take it, of course. And she wandered amongst the crowd. I never seen her afterwards. I didn't remember seeing her going ashore because it was dark, you see. Anyway, I went down this North Channel that the pilot had shown me. Different chance. Well, we saved an hour sailing. You see? Anyway, off we went for Weymouth.
Weymouth,
right. Weymouth. We were due there at about 1 o'clock in the morning. Well, 12:30. There was a big tank just outside the harbour had been torpedoed and sunk. And we go down to the Nash and come up the bay now. Steam up along the bay, along the land and into the harbour. I'd never been that port in my life, no one else had been, so we'd have went pretty carefully, you see. I remember going in there alongside this jetty, I was leaning over the bridge rail like that, and touching the telegraph, so the engine in, the skipper's clicking his heels, got very excited, you see. George clicked his heels, we're all right, Captain, we've been in alongside. You wouldn't believe this, we tell you. And these lights were shining on the quay, on the door, and you could see all these children and women and people there, and soldiers and officers, all there. And anyhow, next day I heard, "Ah, damn it, that you, Kittler!" And a fellow called Connell, Chris Connell. Now down along the beach here, you'll see a house called The Mount, a big house off in the field, up off the shore. Well, they lived there. There's Chris Connell, the two brothers of them and a sister. Well, this was Chris. I knew we were great pals, Chris. And I'd never seen him before. He was the OC troops down there, you see. I was a bit of a yard shot in the bridge, but he had to go disappear. I'd never seen him afterwards. Was it, he's a high-pitched voice to the wolfy head. I got that, you kid. I never so glad to have an ex voice in my life.
Go back.
To back out, then go to Portland to bunker.
So you unloaded all the children?
On?
You
offloaded all the children, no. They got them aboard, stacked them aboard, you know. And I said, up with love, you know, my room was about as big as this. I was, there was a whole Sunday school there. Must have about 30 or 40 children in it, you see. And they'd no food. They'd eaten their sandwiches. And we only had our own rations on board, you see. Seaman's rations. And we were well through them at that time, too. That's the captain's going to be desperate. We were only in there about midnight. Now it was about 10 o'clock in the morning, you see. That had been the middle of it. But I said, "Tell what we can do, Captain. With your permission, you're..." "What's that? What's that?" I said, let's rob the lifeboats. There's candy sugar, there's condensed milk, chocolate. Damn good idea, he said. So I went to the chief officer, who was above me. I said, recommend her. Oh, that's not right, oh, you're getting in trouble. Well, it's up to the captain, says, we can do it, and we will do it. You see, I had to override him. See, I quite understand what he meant, but then there's a war on. They killed them, children were starving. The skipper clicked, so you thought I'd never go down here. So I got the boat with me, one or two sailors, and we got the stuff out of the lifeboat.
Were there people looking after the children apart from, I mean, were there people with them accompanying the children?
No, there are no children, no adults, no parents with them.
No.
They're just the children, that's all, no parents. I think there's a couple of doctors. And they went down, and I went down my cabin, and I see them, and they're on the settee, they're up on the table, and my bunk, and a Sunday school teacher there. I said, are they hungry? Miss, I forget what her name was now. Oh yes, they're starving, they've got no food, they've eaten their sandwiches, you see. She had some biscuits, what she bought herself. Well, I said, and I opened it in the condensed, Nestle's condensed milk, and spooned them right. You see it in that book? Spooned it all round about, you see. And then the biscuits, and with candy sugar, he loved that. And another toffee had a twist in it, with sugar. And he loved that, and that's what he had to eat. That's all he had to eat, was turning out to. And then they went from there into this train and away up to Glasgow.
Right, so they
landed.
Right. Yeah. So they're taken all the way up to Glasgow on the train?
Yes, that's right. And you know, we had a little Lewis gun up for it. And I said to the chief officer, best of me is cover that damn thing up. Because if we get a spotter plane coming out, which one did, and spot us and see that machine gun, we've had it. You see, imagine bombing a ship like that with all those children aboard. It's a tragedy, terrible tragedy. Hey, the one did come out, but he just circled around and went back. See, we got the only best German I ever met, this chap. Anyway, we got in the Weymouth, we got rid of the gym, went to Portland and bunkered. And then we went to, then, back to Southampton. And there's another funny thing, a bloomer of the Royal Navy, you see. Talking awfully far back, these chaps, you see. And I was up to do something with the crew. And the chief officer, Kidley, the captain, would like to have a word with you in his room. I'd seen two naval officers going in there. And they were then, and he says, well, he says, particularly, we're going to Norway. Gone, and you said, that's a damn stuff, we can't go to Norway. Well, these officers seem to believe we can. Well, I said, how range? He said, 300 miles. Once you got there, we had to have coal and water. She's a coal burner, you see. If you bring a reservoir one side and a coal mine the other side, yes, we can make it there, all right, go to New York. And they really thought we could go to Narvik. There's trouble on Narvik that they landed troops at Narvik. We were supposed to go there with troops. We'd never got there. We'd been going yet. See? So, of course, it had to be cancelled. Well, then, we took her up to Barrow and to lay her up. She wasn't there until she was out again. Because she carried troops, no trouble, 5,000 or 6,000. But she's a coal burner. All these flames in the funnel going along, and you can see it's 20 mile long, yeah. Which you do it very fast, you do about 23 knots. Then we got back to Barrow, and I used to go home for a fortnight's holiday. Now, I must go back now, about 3 months before the war started. And at that time, the Admiralty's come around to all the different brokers in Liverpool, asking, in the case of emergency, in the pilot cutter at the bar, and it was mined or torpedoed, and a loss, big loss of life in one, have any masters, with a master's Liverpool pilot ticket, and a master's ticket, available in emergency to join the pilot service. Well, the only man in our company was me. You see, I'd been master at 22, and I had my pilot license, and to keep it going each year, only cost 10 pounds. And when I left and come into the steam pilot, you see, I said to Kinley, the superintendent, obviously, I've got a pilot's license. Well, whoever heard about the second mate having a pilot's license? No, we're not going to buy it. It only cost him £10 a year, you see. But I had it. And I was the only officer in the steam packet that had qualified for that. All the rest is good second mates, qualified men, but they hadn't a pilot's license. And I'd never been master, you see. I was lucky or unlucky when you look at it. So I Mr. Offord, well, he said, someone has put their name down because... Well, I said, don't think there's anybody on you, me. No, he said, I was going to tell you that. didn't know you. Well, I do realise it. But I said, yes, I'll because if we didn't, at least one officer from each company, and there were all sorts of companies, the coasting companies, they could have turned nasty after the war when the younger men went up for their licence, you see. It didn't, but they could have been. So I joined the plan, so I put my name down for it anyway. This was 3 months before the war started. But when Dunkirk finished, and the evacuation, we finished with St. Petersburg and back in Barrow, when I got home, there was a telegram waiting for me to proceed forthwith to the Liverpool Band Service. And that's why I was there for 5 years, the rest of the war. Yeah.
What did you do there?
Well, that was a difficult job too. Exciting job, right enough. It's in that little book. And our job, we would take ships up to 600 ton net. We were what they call temporary pirates, local pirates, you see. But finished up by taking liners up as well. You know, whatever ship come along, you took it, and things got that busy. But however, I went in to the pilot service. I had to go before the committee. And I had to be re-examined. Well, he says, it's not an examination, you may be abundantly clear, but you're just giving you, brighten you up with the river is today, which I already knew anyway, because we've been sailing in there. I told them more about the damn river. So I more or less said that, yes, we know that, Kim, yes, that's what we do, but we've got to do this, it's a bylaw. And I said, that's all. Really a matter of chatting, you and I are chatting now, you see. Well, then I went home on leave for just a few days. I forget how much I think to give me 4 days. I was on the pilot system now, you see, left the steam back in my house. And, you know, the manager says, the steam back says to me, well, you'll have to pay me your next passage out, she said, as a passenger. Hey, how low could they damn well get? Yeah. Well, that doesn't worry me, but I'm not going to, just to say, oh, I'm turned aboard that ship and let anybody stop me. Yeah. I'll put it in the press what happened. Won't give it to press and won't trouble you. I don't do that for a joke. But however, I went in the pilot service then, and I was 5 years there. The day we're all finished, you see. But that night, I was at the pilot cutter at the time, I says to the captain of the pilot cutter, well, I'm finished, that's from midnight. I don't want to be in this job any longer. It's not my job. I've been 5 years, 4 years. But there's three of us asked to remain. Was Dick Parry, Ernie Gaynor, and myself. She was 15 of us all together. I said, this is one of us asked, but I didn't want to stay in it. I always want to go past the bar, not stay at the bar. Anyhow, it's some exciting times, though.